is gonna have the news.
It is Monday, June 15th. This is LA Podcast. I'm Alyssa Walker. We have Hayes Davenport. We do not have a Scott Frazier.
No, we've lost him to a celebration of love. He is celebrating his wedding anniversary with his partner, Sarah. We really wish them well. He deserves a podcasting break for a week. I think this week we're going to get away from the day-by-day structure that we've been doing the episodes in for the last few weeks and kind of talk about the big stories of this week. Kind of fall into three buckets, which are the ongoing Black Lives Matter protests and uprising and efforts at policy change around the city. The COVID-19 outbreak we have not really talked about much for the last couple of weeks, but is increasingly relevant to talk about again. And also homelessness. We had the homeless count numbers released on Friday. We'll get into what those were with a great guest, Anna Scott from KCRW, who reports on homelessness and has a new podcast called Samaritans out of KCRW that she talks about as well. So that is, we have an agenda. And let's start with the first bucket. Alyssa, do you want to talk a little bit about the protests this week and some of the things that happened?
We're having some really nice interest group protests now. So you have people who are coming together from different aspects of Black Lives Matter and how they connect with local issues. So we had this really powerful protest. I was not there at Echo Park Lake on Saturday. That was all about Black unhoused lives matter. They had some incredible speakers. It culminated with a march to Mitch O'Farrell's office where all the signs were hung up. Kind of this, a quilt of of these incredible messages.
Led by Ashley Bennett, who works with Ground Game LA and was a former LASA caseworker until she was fired by LASA. And the theory and the evidence shows that it was because LASA was called by Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell and said that she should be reprimanded for inciting chaos or something like that.
So that turned out to have been a mistake. So she did that, yeah. She's continued to do that.
Yes.
We also had a very sizable protest in the Valley at CSUN taking over this, those streets are very wide in the Valley and they are very well suited to to protest. And there was one shot I saw of, I can't remember the exact intersection, but it's the most dangerous intersection in the city. It has the most crashes.
I think it's Nordhoff and Reseda or something.
Yeah, I don't know exactly which one, but it's right by CSUN and just people in every direction. Just a really remarkable turnout for that one. And then
about specifically CSUN police and divesting from that police force, like all the different, and the USC as well has had a big issue with this. I haven't seen a protest centered around that, although it may have happened, but Soros Lyman at Streets Blog has written a lot about the stepped up enforcement by the USC police. So campus police being part of this equation is a new conversation that's happening also in our public school system.
Yes. And that's another thing that's coming up this week. We saw the teachers union, UTLA, finally make an announcement about, saying that we actually do want this to happen. We saw Denver's public schools and Minneapolis's public schools both kick police out of their schools. And here, we have a school police force in Los Angeles.
It's not part of LAPD.
It's not, but it is, a funded police force. It's actually called the LA School Police. Yeah, it's very large because we're obviously a large school district. But again, you have tens of millions of dollars being paid and to these officers or whoever they are, public safety officers, I guess they're technically police, who are arresting kids in elementary school, first of all. And of course, disproportionately, they are Black students that are being harassed and arrested and, enforced. So another huge problem and too many resources being devoted to this. And there was an article that was floating around a lot about, it was actually from 2014, that was like LAUSD giving back grenade launchers or something like that, which was, yes, it was true back then, but it's an older article. But I think it's kind of the same issue that's still, you know, maybe we don't have the grenade launchers, but we probably have lots of other things that we don't need to have in our
schools.
Yeah,
they said they were keeping, I think, their mine-proof, like, tank, essentially.
Yeah,
they
have, sure, because, of course, you need that when you are trying to get kindergartners to listen to you.
They have that machine that they showed pictures of. Jason Kander, former Senate candidate, posted a picture of it. Compared it to the car that he actually drove around in Afghanistan, which was like a minivan. And he didn't even point out that that was not a normal police vehicle. That is a school police.
Right. Vehicle. That's a school. Yeah. It's just especially for schools. So they're having a march coming up on Tuesday at the Miguel Contreras Learning Center towards downtown. And that will be, that's part of this other really great group that schools deserve. And they've been really doing the organizing with Black Lives Matter and kind of like, you know, wrapping together all these school, we had to wait for school to be out. Last day of school was last week. So now we can start protesting, get all the kids out there and learning this summer. So that was exciting. And then also we're recording this on Sunday and there was a very large protest happening in Hollywood. Do you want to talk more about that, Hayes?
Yes. So this was the All Black Lives Matter protest that coincides with Pride that's happening in New York. And this protest focuses on the specific experiences of Black LGBTQ plus people. It goes from West Hollywood to Hollywood. This is a protest. This is really complicated. And I actually encourage people to go to the Twitter account of Jasmine Canick to learn a little bit more about what has actually happened. But this protest met with some controversy. So every year, we have LA Pride in West Hollywood. It's led by a group called Christopher Street West. And this year, they announced in the aftermath of George Floyd's death and the protests that they were going to be doing, instead of a normal Pride, it was going to be a Black Solidarity March. Implied at least, or used the terminology of Black Lives Matter and sort of implied that it was in coordination with Black Lives Matter in some way. It was not. They had not gone to Black Lives Matter LA to talk about having this march. And it did turn out that what they went to instead first was the police. They sent, the organizer of the event sent a letter to LAPD celebrating their long, great relationship with LAPD. People within Black Lives Matter did not appreciate that outreach to LAPD instead of Black Lives Matter. And there were some people speaking up saying that this does not appear to be in the spirit of the movement that is happening right now. And in general, there were people talking about how LA Pride, we talked about this in our Patreon episode where we watched and talked about the movie Tangerine this week, about how LA Pride has become a very commercialized event. I think that is fair to say. We also related specifically to the issue of Pride's ongoing relationship with the police force. We got an anonymous tip from someone who did the research on Pride and the Sheriff's Department and kind of how they work together. So West Hollywood is policed by the Sheriff's Department. The center of Pride is right on Santa Monica Boulevard, right by the huge sheriff station that they have there. And if you go through the numbers, as this anonymous tipster did, of Pride's financial forums, they have gotten donated sheriff services and the amount of, in 2018, it was over $1 million in donated help from the sheriff's department. And that has gone up significantly every year. Well, in 2017, it was $900,000. In 2016, it was $593,000. So similar to kind of how we've looked at the police budgets increasing, the donated law enforcement presence has been rising and rising really quickly at Pride. So what happened was, in response to criticism, Pride LA and Christopher Street West said, "We are not involved in this march at all." And then another group formed, that it was formed by two members of LA Pride's board who are Black, and said, "We are forming a new organization that is going to operate this different march that I think follows a similar route that is called All Black Lives Matter. Jasmine Canik and others have pointed out that there is a lot of overlap between LA Pride and this new organization that is called BLAC. The acronym is BLAC. And it does seem like LA Pride understanding that what they did was wrong. They submitted an apology. They said they moved too quickly. They did not go through this process in the correct way, but still wanting to have the march just without like specifically their name on it. It's convoluted. It's complicated, but Jasmine as a journalist has been really out there talking about this issue.
And now, and if you want to talk about, you know, lasting effects of it, there's a giant mural now down Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, we got one.
All Black Lives Matter. So
every other city has, except ours is a little,
ours is a little different. And I like to the complicated nature of this. Now it's kind of has a lasting impact and will be photographed and shared and social mediated through this. So that's probably going to be, you know, a little bit difficult for people. So I don't know. It looks pretty.
It was nicely executed in a very short time by all appearances. It was put together, I think, by a promotional, like a PR firm called Trailer Park.
Yeah, their offices are right there, I think. Yeah. But again, is that crossing into this weird, like, advertising, you know, are we capitalizing on this movement? You know, what's going on here? You know,
it's a tough conversation to have.
Yeah.
What happened in Beverly Hills this week?
Oh, well, this is fun. This is not a tough conversation.
No, this is a very easy conversation.
As predicted, Beverly Hills will not have this, will not stand for people daring to use its streets again mm-hmm. for their freedom of expression. So they issued a statement, kind of, it's like this list of like, here are all the bad things that happened in Beverly Hills over the last few weeks. So it's like, whereas on May 30th, 2020, Beverly Hills was potentially subject to violent protests, you know, and then it was, you know, it makes all these lists. And then I didn't know as much about this other incident. On June 12th, a group called Occupy conducted a second nighttime protest in the residential area of the city that began at 10 p.m. and continued until approximately 1 a.m. And it goes on to say that there were bullhorns and amplified music that disturbed people when they were sleeping. Like, it literally says this, like, in the order. So what they have done is they have created some rules, and no more than 10 people are allowed to gather in an assembly in a residential area between the hours of 9 p.m. and 8 a.m. So this is basically like a kind of a curfew, I guess, unless
doesn't it say you can gather, but you must be quiet?
Yes. Well, the exception is if it is a silent, gathering. So I don't, that's in like the part four or whatever of the, any assembly that is silent is exempt from this proclamation.
This is like genius constitutional law. So we have freedom of speech and we have freedom of assembly, but we don't have freedom of speech and assembly. So you can speak without assembling, or you could assemble without speaking in Beverly Hills. Scott called it, said they were dropping the portcullis, which I thought was...
It goes for public places, but it doesn't, obviously, you know, it says in there, it's okay if you gather on a private property, which I don't really think you're supposed to do anyway because of the stay-at-home orders that are still under effect, but they noted to include that, I guess, just in case you were worried you couldn't have a protest maybe in your own home or something like that, or occupy your own mansion, right, or perhaps. So this was very interesting. I read it as like a challenge to have the most amazing silent protest in Beverly Hills, or maybe to like walk the, they have these streets that are kind of spell out this residential zone. So maybe you walk the perimeter of it without actually going in silence mm-hmm. or something like that, and do it like every night.
Beverly Hills famously has its own police force. And this is a good segue, actually. So they did, on the night of June 12th, they did tear gas protesters. They have liberally used tear gas over the last few weeks when protesters make incursions into Beverly Hills. there was a lot of conversation around this resulting from Mayor Garcetti's appearance on the online show of The Appeal, which is a kind of social justice oriented news organization. He went on this show. People are like, wow, this is brave, because they really are going to ask him some tough questions. One thing that we talked about on the website today, I did a blog post about something that he said about tear gas. I'll just play that clip really fast.
So the firsthand accounts, as you describe, Mr. Mayor, show and describe brutal tactics by LAPD using tear gas and rubber or foam bullets against demonstrators.
We don't use tear gas in Los Angeles, and we have not used tear gas in 50 years.
An LA Times reporter was injured in Minneapolis, by Minneapolis police using similar tactics. And now Congress is debating a total ban of the use of these dangerous weapons. Would you support a total ban on the use of rubber and foam bullets and tear gas in Los Angeles?
Yeah, we don't use tear gas, so we don't need to. And it's not part of our policy, and we don't have that. We haven't done that in over 50 years.
So he very directly says that LAPD not only doesn't use tear gas, it's not in their policy and they don't have it. He's like upset. Doesn't he sound upset in that clip about like being asked about it at all?
How dare you?
But you can see in the blog post, LAPD does use tear gas. They do have it. And it is in their policy explicitly that they can use it for crowd control. I haven't seen specific evidence that they used it in the recent protests. There's some like on the 110, LAPD was in the lead when protesters shut down the 110 around like May 29th, and there was tear gas used then. That could have been California Highway Patrol. I haven't seen reports on that one way or the other, but it appears to have mostly been used by the LA Sheriff's Department, who has been called was called in for backup on Fairfax, right, and immediately just started hucking tear gas grenades, which we've now learned like, again, are banned by the United Nations for use in war, but also spread COVID, make people more susceptible to coronavirus. But you can check out that post. But I want to talk about some other news that he made in this interview with The Appeal, where he was asked directly about his support for DA Jackie Lacey, who we've talked about on the show. But she is, I think, a beleaguered DA at this point. Black Lives Matter has been protesting her office every week for years. The size of those protests has grown somewhat over the last few weeks, and they protested the fact that she has never charged a police officer with the wrongful death or murder of any of the hundreds of people that LAPD and the Sheriff's Department have killed since she's been in office. So Mayor Garcetti got asked directly if he still supported her candidacy, and this is what he said.
Do you still support your endorsement of District Attorney Lacey? Is it time for a change in that office?
It may be, and she's somebody who I've worked with. Just to put in context, my father, before he was district attorney, led the first unit that went after police brutality in the United States of America. I grew up at the dinner table hearing conversations where he'd go to roll calls and officers in a very old and different LAPD, not saying we don't have still progress to make, used to say, if you were dying on the ground, bleeding to death, I'd step over you and let you die. The chops that I have and that I know about demand that we do have justice. I was glad to see her put forward prosecution for, you might have seen the video of the beating of somebody who was experiencing homelessness in Boyle Heights in our community. And I think it's important that we do not only prosecute, but that we get convictions. And that's on all of us, by the way, because even when prosecutors do, juries don't convict. This is a moment for America to say, it's not just about prosecutors, it's not just about investigations. But when we line up many of the pieces in the chain, the last link in that chain breaks. And that's people on juries who don't want to convict police officers when they should. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for George Gascon, too. I've served alongside him. It was before he entered the race, my endorsement was with Miss Lacey, but I want to continue to make sure she does the job that she should be doing. And I want to make sure that that office, no matter who's in it, is going after folks when they commit crimes. And a badge does not protect you. These are very difficult convictions to get, but until people see justice there, they wonder, will justice actually be equal for anyone?
So there's, a huge amount going on in that answer. It is a museum piece, Garcetti answer, and I do want to get into the details of it. But the first three letters are the first three words are the most newsmaking. Asked if it's time for a new DA, What does he say?
It may be.
It may be. That's a giant deal. And like LA politics, I mean, that is like, is hurling somebody
but
under
still
the bus.
So Garcetti, so spaghetti Garcetti to just say it may
it is.
Be.
Yes. And to go straight from that to this anecdote that he has been telling a lot in the last few, I'm sure he's mentioned it on the Garcetti show, sitting at the dinner table with his dad as his dad yes. told stories about how the old LAPD would threaten his life or at least yeah. threaten not to save him if he were in trouble. Of course, the new LAPD is very different and they have been making threats to Garcetti, absolutely, but it's slightly more veiled than that about yeah. pulling his security detail and things of that nature. And then going
and then
from
the part where it's actually your fault because it's
that's
actually
the best.
It's actually when if you're on the jury and you don't do this, it's up to you, LA.
Yes. And it's like, well, give us a chance, I guess. We haven't had a ton of chances.
Prosecute them and then we would help
to weigh in on that process. But yeah, that was nice to learn how much more I could do as part of being a link in this chain.
He doesn't want people to skip out on their jury duty. I mean, that's what he's really trying to say, like, come serve.
And these also, I mean, just like masterful at like when he talked about, he said he was glad to see that Jackie Lacey charged that someone, he said, was charged for the beating of the unhoused person, but doesn't say it was an LAPD officer who beat up someone who was homeless. Just like his ability to like not say certain words when it's hard not to say them because of the circumstances, what actually happened. But yeah, and he said he gives a little boost to George Gascon. I mean, in LA politics, that is like a the knife in the back compared to what they normally do. They
it's
never
like a,
back down.
It's a butter knife in the back.
Right. But, yes.
We're getting there.
Yeah. He also has talked in that interview and a lot recently about how they are investigating officers for uses of force during the recent protests. We had a few council members come forward with motions to investigate this process. I thought Mike Bonin's and Marquise Harris Dawson's was the most impactful because they talked about appointing an independent inspector general. Usually these things are kind of handled in-house by LAPD. And they recommended a guy named Jerry Chaliff, who was the former president of the police commission and was fired in 2001 by Mayor Rick Riordan, basically for being too hard on police, and has been involved in other investigations in the past. So he's like a real deal person to come in and oversee this, not someone who has the friendliest relationship with LAPD. So that is something to keep an eye on. Another, Garcetti's also talked about the fact that 7 officers, I think, have been taken out of the field for their involvement in the using excessive force during the protests. But I was looking back through, I'm sure almost everyone listening to this has seen Nick Andert's video showing a lot of different uses of force. And that one, the end of the clip, where there are all these officers kneeled around this woman who they are tasering over and over again for a very long time, and you can hear the taser going. There were 8 officers there, so that the number of officers who were present for that obvious excessive use of force is more than the number that have been taken out of the field. So there might be a few left to go. We also want to talk about ongoing investigations in the outside of LA City and the outer parts of the county. In Palmdale, a man, 24-year-old man named Robert Fuller, was found on Wednesday morning hanging from a tree by Palmdale City Hall. The LA Sheriff's Department and the coroner's office pretty much immediately called it a suicide. The family of Robert Fuller does not believe it was a suicide, and they are, and actually the sheriff's department then did apologize for coming to that conclusion so quickly. And they said that they should have said that that was just the first result of their investigation. They're saying they are investigating it. This is actually, this comes after the death of a man named Malcolm Harsh in Victorville back on May 31st. And that's in San Bernardino County, but he died, was also found hanging and died in a very similar way. That's also being investigated. There was also a police killing in San Bernardino this week of a Hispanic man and another police killing of a black man in LA by the LA Sheriff's Department, a man named Michael Thomas, who's 62 years old. On Thursday morning, police were called to his residence about a verbal domestic dispute and ended up kicking in his door and trying to arrest him in his living room. And then they said, a deputy said that Michael Thomas tried to grab his gun and he shot him. The deputy killed him in his living room. And the family also says in that case that he was not reaching for a gun and should not have been in that situation in the first place because it was just a verbal domestic dispute. And so these things are piling up so quickly that it's a little difficult to even keep track of.
Right. And just for some more national context, what we saw happen in Atlanta this weekend, which was another situation where somebody called 911 because a black man was asleep in his car in a, you know, a fast food restaurant. And which is, you know, the natural response for, I think, some people who they see as this is a nuisance or I don't want to deal with this and I'm going to call 911. Please shut up. They shot and killed him. Massive protests, and the police chief resigned and the officer was fired. But the point that people keep bringing up is like, if this is what is going to continue to happen as the attention of the entire world is on how police officers are treating black individuals in this country, and they're still killing people. I mean, that should really let you know that the police is not going to change its ways. The police needs to be eliminated or you know, defunded in with how the conversation is going. And another national conversation in Minneapolis, they did pass, the city council did pass very sweeping reform. That it is reform, but it is saying that, you know, no more police. It's like a different public safety organization is being created. And that passed readily, even though I don't know what is going to happen with the mayor in particular, who has said it is not going to be defunded, but they did it. And the language is quite strong. So there are things happening and there are changes that are being made in other cities.
The Michael Thomas story, I think, is a great example of how the presence of an armed officer makes a situation much more dangerous, and the cycle of violence that comes from just the fact that they're carrying a gun, because the Michael Thomas was completely unarmed. They broke into his place, and then just by virtue of the fact that they said that they believed that he was attempting to grab the gun, gave them the right to kill him.
That escalates it, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about updates in the COVID-19 outbreak in Los Angeles. We have not gotten good news lately on this front. Cases are up. The percentage of positive cases per test are up. The tests are down somewhat and have been since the protests began. Hospitalizations are also up, which tend to be a reliable indicator of the severity of the crisis. We had the single highest day of new cases on Thursday, 1,848 cases, despite not that many tests being done. At one point, we were down to 5% positive new cases per test. And we are now at more than 11% of tests being positive, and up to 40 deaths per day is the running 7-day average. And back on the 27th, that number was 32 deaths per day. Alyssa, what do you think this is related to? Is it the protests or the reopening of the city?
Yeah, they said we won't see the bump in protests quite yet. It'd be a 2-week lag. So I guess we might start to see that this week, but I've also seen so many stories about just how much more we know about this now. There was studies this week even that came out about the risk of transmission on public transit, basically saying that they can't find very many cases where people even got it from riding subway trains and buses together. Although we did have a metro operator die this week, which of COVID-19, which is very sad.
First bus operator, I believe.
Yeah. And then they, you know, again, like the ongoing studies that are showing how much more just being outside and moving around really is not any kind of high risk situation. If you are wearing a mask and you're doing your best to, you know, stay away from people, but it really doesn't seem like marching and protests are going to have that big of an impact. We could see that. But I also think a lot of people, you know, are really being responsible about going to get tested right away. And I know some people who are like going to a protest and won't go to another protest for like 14 days to make sure that they are okay. And then getting tested. So I think there's really responsible ways to do it and that people are taking good precautions. A lot of people going in cars or doing other things like supporting by giving out water and things like that if they don't feel comfortable marching. So I think you're right that it's more about this kind of cavalier and uneven reopening response, and that we've seen an increase or just not really maybe an increase in cases. They like to say that the hospitalizations are going down, that our deaths are kind of steady, and we knew, I guess, our curve would be long and plateauy, but the cases should still be going down if we were actually taking the right precautions. And you look at like other large cities in Europe, that places like in Germany and other places that did have, you know, cases and deaths, but the cases immediately started to go down based on the restrictions. And I just don't see, they just keep saying it's about testing being more widely available, but we should still start to see the number of cases going down, I feel like. Or when will we? What change will bring that about as we continue to open up museums and, mm-hmm. you know, hotels? I don't know.
Yeah. So when we look back at the data, and there are a few people tracking this with good visualizations, there's a Twitter user named Leora, who I rely on a lot, at Leora_. And what we see is, so retail started to open in LA around mid-May was when first it was Mother's Day when they reopened flower stores and other kinds of retail. And then others got reopened for curbside pickup. And then on May 27th, all retail opened for in-store use. And then on May 29th, then restaurants reopened. And then everything reopened this past Friday, pretty much, with the exception of, I think, movie theaters are kind of the last frontier. And sports obviously haven't come back. But what we see is we had a big drop in all of our stats, deaths, hospitalizations, everything, around May 18th. And it kept kind of declining until May 27th. And I remember, you know, I checked these every day and being like kind of encouraged. Deaths were going down. We got down to 32 deaths, the 7-day average on May 27th, the 5% positive tests. And right around then, it seemed like the county health department and the mayor's office and the state kind of noticed that drop happening and decided to seize on it as the opportunity to reopen instead of letting that drop kind of take root. It was used more as justification to reopen business, and the act of reopening business basically immediately reversed those positive effects. So since May 27th, we have seen a gradual increase on pretty much every one of these metrics, including hospitalizations. Like Barbara Ferrer said on Friday in the LA Times, she was quoted as saying that LA County has seen slight declines in both the positivity rate and number of hospitalizations. That is not true in the month of June.
Yeah, it doesn't. It might have been for May, but I don't, if anything, it's kind of like flat and slightly going back up again.
And it did. We have seen a decline from the peak, but right. The important thing is where you are now. And we are on our way back up as we reopen gyms, which we did on Friday, and almost every other place. I mean, I know people that teach like yoga and Pilates and are going back to these like enclosed rooms with maybe fewer people in the room, but this is going to get worse. And it's very obvious at this point already that people have died as a result of this reopening, which is so much more abrupt than a place like San Francisco and others.
And it's going to be, once again, you know, it's funny that we talked about essential workers, right? And now these are non-essential things that people just want to go out and do because they're bored or they can't stand being at home anymore, or capitalism is completely screwed us over and we're too worried that our city cannot survive unless we have a gym open or something. But again, like, the workers are going to suffer from this and are going to be forced back or have to make really difficult decisions that they have someone at home who is immunocompromised or who have kids, because there is still no childcare options for a lot of people in the city. And grandparents, you know, hopefully people are starting to form pods. They haven't even really gotten into that part of it yet, where it's like you could join up with another family and do childcare. They haven't offered that as part of the guidance locally, but they have said some childcare centers can open. But without that in place, or without free childcare, or without better options for people who are working, you're going to have to choose between risking your life, not being able to make money, not being able to pay rent on July 1st. And it's completely backwards the way that we're reopening the city.
A good example of what's happening that a number of people sent me is, we played on a previous episode, a radio ad I heard in the car from Morongo Casino that I found to be very scary, celebrating the fact that they were reopening and saying basically, like, fuck it, let's
Morongo. Morongo.
Let's just do it and be legends. And now a Morongo Casino manager has COVID. And an employee who was presumably forced back to work by this casino reopening now has contracted coronavirus. Awful, awful story. And it is very scary to think what we could be seeing over the next few weeks.
I'd say just continue to stay home as much as you can. I mean, it's unfortunately, people are not giving us that choice as a city. But if it's the same rule from the very beginning, when we started to lock down, when I was trying to make the argument that if you can limit your interactions as much as possible, you should still continue to do that. And if you're privileged enough to do that, you should still continue to do that. And it will help.
Yeah. It's a luxury right now. And so, like, the ideal scenario, I think, for a lot of people in the service industry is, I guess, that they go to work and they get paid, but they have to deal with as few customers as possible. And I know it's a hit to business, but we have to worry about keeping people alive in this moment. Homeless count, giant news this week. Let's talk about it with our guest, Anna Scott from KCRW, and about her new podcast, Samaritans, on LA Podcast.
We have a great guest here with us today, a very relevant person to talk us through a big moment from this week, the numbers from the homeless count. Anna Scott, who is a journalist at KCRW. I get to bump into her I used to when we would be in person, but when we could bump into people. When I would go to KCRW to record my segment for Greater LA, she has been
We're very gracious about plugging other podcasts.
Yeah, we make sure that we talk about every other person creating great work. But Anna has been working on a year-long project, your project?
Yeah.
Wow. So, and kind of culminating with this bit of data that we got dropped this week, it was just the perfect time to have her on and talk about it. So welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you.
Anna, your new show is called Samaritans for KCRW. It is a limited series.
Yep, that's right. It's called Samaritans. It's a four-part podcast, so you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And I followed a woman named Christine Curtis for more than a year, who had been homeless for 7 years when I met her at the beginning of 2019, and just followed her through the system, basically, for a year. And it was very eye-opening.
Yeah, we want to talk about the show, but let's lead off talking about the homeless count announcement. Just a little behind the scenes, I saw that Matt Tinoco at LAist, who also reports on homelessness, who's been on the show talking about it with us before, mentioned this group Zoom call of journalists who work in housing and homelessness that I think both of you were on, Alyssa and Anna.
Yep.
And he mentioned just the looks of shock on people's faces when they released the numbers. Was that your experience as well? And then let's get into what the numbers actually were.
Well, I had to join that call from my phone, actually, which is a long story, but with a defunct laptop. And so I did not actually see the whole gallery of faces in that media briefing that happened a couple of days before the official release. But they released it to reporters so that we could talk through it and digest it to all put out our stories on Friday. And I will say personally, I think the report is shocking in terms of the circumstances that we're living with here in Los Angeles. The numbers are horrific and there's no other way to look at it, but I didn't find it surprising at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you,
that,
Alyssa.
Yeah, I think that that's a very good way to put it. Like, I was definitely shocked. I do wish I had screen grabbed kind of just seeing people's faces. But then I think what followed was not shocking. Like you said, like kind of like the same way that they had explained it the year before, which was they kept pushing the point that like we've housed more people than ever, which I think, again, was true. And also trying to make it about how much of the efforts like post count, you know, this number you're seeing is from January when we had a different world. And you can see with your own eyes that the problem has gotten worse just in the last few months. You can see how many more tents are up. You can see how many, you know, people have just continued to be pushed out of the system or not able to get help. So it was funny to see, to even have them talk about the context of like Project Room Key. And that doesn't really have anything to do with the count number. You know, that is maybe very small yeah. thing to celebrate in the context.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what the actual numbers were, just to give people some context. Anna, what did they announce on Friday?
So more than 66,000 people are experiencing homelessness throughout LA County. It's 66,433, I want to say.
Yeah, always with the accuracy down to the last digit, as if they have any idea.
Absolutely, but, yeah. Of course, this is an estimate, and actually, it's also a minimum, really. Just last year, I spoke to a county official who told me that the number of people who fall into homelessness in Los Angeles County in a given year is probably in the hundreds of thousands, but a lot of those people might sleep on a couch for a week, might stay with friends. You know, they never enter the system. They never land on the street. You don't know about it. So what the count is actually collecting is a minimum. And there's been quite a bit of attention on the fact that some of the council offices before the count was conducted in January ordered some sweeps of encampments in their districts, which may have also depressed the numbers. So this is a minimum that we're looking at. It's about a little less than a 13% increase over last year. So we're pretty much seeing, at least the last couple of years, steady increase. And now this is the fifth increase in 6 years. So
almost a 13% increase, yeah, at the county level, off of a 12% increase countywide last year. A almost 14% increase at the city level, which is slightly less than an increase by last year, which was 16%. And yeah, what you're alluding to, we talked about on the podcast. At the time, there were huge sweeps of Sepulveda Basin, which had hundreds of people who were homeless, and Nuri Martinez's district as essentially her first act as council president, and also attempted sweeps at Echo Park Lake. That was actually, I think, when a lot of the conflict between the residents of Echo Park Lake and Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell really hit the news, was some big attempted sweeps of that area, which has between 60 and 100 people who are homeless at any given time. I'll say I was pretty shocked for that reason. I thought that like the system had been gamed a little bit, but also just because we were coming off such a big increase last year, I thought that the increase would level off a little bit. But it has sustained to this huge degree. Was there anything else in the data that they released that was interesting to you?
Well, yeah, there are some disturbing jumps in some subsets of the homeless population. We saw a pretty significant jump among seniors experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. And this is a group of people that experienced a lot of loss and financial hardship back in 2008. So one theory is that that's affecting them now. people don't have a lot of savings, who are retirement age or older, and they're increasingly falling into homelessness with the cost of housing in Los Angeles. Also, transition age youth, which has been on the rise before this year too, with people aging out of foster care. There was a pretty significant jump there.
That's 18 to 24.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And there was a huge jump in homeless families, which they attribute to doing better counting of homeless families. So it's, you could make an analogy to COVID testing. If you, the more people you test, the more cases you're going to get. Yeah. So they were able to find more families who were living in motels or situations like that who became part of the count, but which is disturbing in and of itself, because it just makes you wonder how many more people there are like that who are not being counted in this official count, but are experiencing homelessness and may fall onto the streets anytime.
So countywide, that is an increase of about 7,000 people compared to last year's count. I was thinking today that that is more people who are homeless year to year than the number of units we will get from Measure HHH over 10 years. That's at the city level, not the county. But I think now we're expected to get something like 5,700 units of actual like supportive housing out of Measure HHH. And it is not even coming close to the pace of increase. What you mentioned too about the number of people falling into homelessness, I think is interesting, because you talked about someone suggesting it was probably over 100,000. But what they said in the numbers that they released was it was about 80,000 plus people fell into homelessness at some point. Lots of people got off the street on their own, most in fact. But the county and LASA and other services actually did house a significant number of people. And it just goes to show like how much bigger the pipeline onto the street is than the one off, right?
Absolutely. And that is the big dynamic behind this, is just people falling out of the housing market because of the incredibly high cost of housing. I do think that the math in the count, it looks very neat and tidy. It looks like this equation, well, 82,000 people fell into homelessness, something like maybe 2/3 of them were able to get out of it on their own. Roughly 23,000 were placed in housing through the system, which is a large number. I think in the weeks to come, we'll all be really digging into these numbers and looking at how they were able to arrive at such precise figures. And you know, I think even though it looks very precise in the count, all of these are just our best guesses, you know, based on data that's hard to collect. But whatever the actual numbers are, that dynamic of just this overwhelming pipeline is continuing year after year after year. And that's the big force behind the numbers that we're seeing.
So on Friday, the mayor had one of his shows and kind of clustered this in with the other major things that we're facing right now as a city, like talking about the disparity for Black Angelenos when it comes to COVID deaths, when it's talking about homelessness, when it's talking about, you know, racial equity and his new campaign to, you know, have this commission or whatever they're going to do. And it's funny because LASA and the people who work with LASA told the city this and the county this 2 years ago with this very detailed report about specifically Black Angelenos facing homelessness. Can you talk a little bit about that report?
Yeah. So this report came out a couple of years ago, like you said, at the end of 2018, by a committee put together by the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, looking at the disproportionate number of Black people experiencing homelessness in LA and coming up with some recommendations to try to decrease that and look at that and look at the racial inequities that are leading to those numbers. Of course, if you followed this issue before 2018, you know that Black people are disproportionately impacted by this crisis, that they're subjected to housing discrimination in all kinds of ways. That's not new information. I mean, I don't know how far back in time you want to go. We could go back to 40 Acres and a Mule. We could go back to 2008 and look at the housing crisis and how disproportionately Black people were targeted for predatory loans and the effects of that. We could look at redlining. There's example after example of this. But in 2018, they put together this committee and they came up with these recommendations. And a lot of the time, this is what the local government does on all kinds of things, definitely housing-related things. They identify a problem, they order a report, and then they sit on the report and do nothing with it. And now, in this moment that we're in, they're dusting off this one and pointing to it and saying, oh, and look, you know, another reason that we have this homelessness crisis is systemic racism, and we've identified it, which is true. But when you say systemic racism in this big, broad way, it divorces it a little bit from the specific policies of Los Angeles City and County. And also, there are very actionable things that were outlined in this report a long time ago that they could have been doing all this time. Like,
I mean, that's about it. It's like a 67-point list with very specific and not that complicated, you know, actions.
Yeah, employing more Black people within the homeless services system, and specifically Black people who have experienced homelessness themselves. They also recommended looking at shelter conditions because they got feedback from surveys that they did about the environments at some shelters and transitional living facilities being traumatic for some Black people experiencing homelessness. So they're recommending to look at why that is and try to improve those conditions.
Yeah, in terms of shelter conditions, specifically something that you hear a lot in homeless services is the shelters around Skid Row, where which is almost entirely Black. There are some that are extremely populated, and the conditions of those shelters that you hear most often are the least sanitary, possibly the least safe.
Yeah, and Skid Row itself, I mean, there's just, by the way, in terms of this not being a new issue, there are a lot of organizations and activists on Skid Row that have talked about systemic racism and the specific role of it in Los Angeles for a long time, and have pointed to Skid Row as an example of this in many ways. I mean, LA CAN, for example, is an organization that's been around a long time and has been talking about this. So I think that it's absolutely true that it is something embedded in the housing system and the homelessness crisis. But I do think that, you know, there's something cynical about highlighting it now all of a sudden when they had this report when they released the 2019 count last year as well. But of course now, obviously, because of all the protests going on and where everybody's minds are, everybody right now is thinking about systemic racism. And so it seems like this is something they've decided to frame this count around.
Yeah, the mayor tweeted it the day after on Saturday, and it was as if it didn't say the study was done 2 years ago or anything. It was just like, oh, there's this report and we should do this. And you were just kind of like, oh, you could have done this. And you would have saved lives. I mean, it's not just people falling back into homelessness or, you know, getting evicted. We've seen the number of people who are dying on the streets go up each year. And of course, that's going to impact Black Angelenos more because there's more people who are homeless who are Black. And it was just to see kind of the framing again, like once again, it's like, we're going to try harder, we're going to do better. Well, it's not enough, and it's not going to be enough, and this approach is not going to work. It's going to be just as bad, if not worse, in a year if we don't make some real major changes.
Yeah, and there are a lot of things. I think, you know, saying, well, one of the things driving this homelessness crisis is systemic racism. That is true, but it also does sound like this big force that's out of the hands of local government. And there are a lot of concrete things that they could be doing about that are outlined in this report, but also other things to tackle housing injustice and homelessness among the Black community in Los Angeles. For example, about a year ago, the city made a new law that made it illegal for landlords to have a blanket policy of rejecting Section 8 voucher holders. So does the city, are they putting resources into enforcing that law? Are they committed to that? I'm not saying they're not. I'm not sure. I think that's an interesting question and something to look into. That's something that they could do. Is every city council member fulfilling the commitment that they made to build 222 units of permanent supportive housing in their districts? At this point, I believe about a third of the council has not met that goal in terms of units that are approved. So are they pushing those projects through? Are they standing up to their own constituents who may not want to live next door to those projects and really fighting for them. That's
well, the deadline is in 2 weeks.
District.
So it's July 1st. So let's not speak too soon. They have plenty of time.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll get it.
Yeah.
To get hundreds of units approved.
And are they finding ways to decriminalize homelessness, you know, and finding ways to not make the LAPD the first responder agency when it comes to homelessness? Because we know that Black people are more likely to be arrested, more likely to be killed by police. So there are a number of very concrete things upstream and downstream that are within their control to prevent more people from falling into homelessness, and specifically to prevent more Black people from falling into homelessness and from suffering the devastating effects of being homeless.
Yeah. And there is a petition out right now to kind of defund LASA, the police within LASA. So there's, a movement afoot to make this part of all this, you know, disinvestment policies to make sure that they are not the first responders and that they are not putting people, you know, in more in harm's way.
Is that what we saw in San? I try not to pay too much attention to San Francisco, but is that what we saw
don't we all?
Up there this week? I think Mayor Breed did put something forward suggesting that there would be fewer armed officers involved in calls related to homelessness?
Yes, for them, it was kind of looped into this, a variety of things. So like not just a response to like a homeless related call, but also like domestic mm-hmm. disputes and things like that. So it was like this whole range of, we're not going to send a police person to your house when it doesn't seem like it's a, you know, very serious issue or serious offense that might escalate into something else. So,
Alyssa, you talked about how the homelessness crisis could be poised to get a lot worse as a result of the pandemic. Anna, what's some of the research that's out there on that possibility?
Yeah, well, we know that people are already missing payments, rent payments, and getting evicted. And there was a study recently that came out of UCLA that made some projections and is predicting that without specifically stronger renter protections, that an additional 36,000 households in LA County, evicted households, could end up homeless. And that was a conservative estimate that was based on how many households are likely to be evicted as a direct result of losing employment or losing income because of COVID-19. And then what I think they estimated that about 10% of those households might become homeless and came up with this 36,000 number, which is incredibly alarming. And I mean, if you think about that, that would push the number of people experiencing homelessness in Los Angeles County to above 100,000.
And that was households. And like, so presumably even more individuals.
Even more
individuals.
I think
I saw the big number. They said it could get as high as 120,000, which is almost unthinkably huge.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a guy named Dr. Gary Blasey at UCLA, who I think he pinned it to, he called it UD Day, Unlawful Detainer Day, which is when the California Judicial Council allows eviction cases to proceed again. We could see a huge number of households getting forced onto the street. But I maybe partially in response to some of the outcry around that, that date has shifted. Is that correct? It was supposed to be, I think, very soon and has now moved.
Yeah, so that was pushed back. It's a little unclear now exactly how long those moratoriums will go on. I mean, right now, there is a state bill that's making its way through the process that's proposing rent forgiveness, because right now what exists is this patchwork of pauses, essentially, on evictions for non-payment of rent that directly related to losing income because of COVID-19. There's also a patchwork of mortgage relief for homeowners in the same situation. But some of the predictions from Gary Blasey's study at UCLA were just, they're saying, you know, if stronger protections aren't implemented, and really, in particular, rent forgiveness, because right now it's this mix of different delays, but people will still owe back rent and still owe their mortgage payments, even if they've lost their jobs or just lost income because of COVID-19. And I mean, if you're out of work, it's hard to see how you're going to pay that back. And so we'll see what happens with it. You know, it's obviously, this is a huge issue. A huge number of households, particularly vulnerable renters, could be impacted. It's also hard to imagine, though, how they would move forward with widespread rent forgiveness without some kind of mortgage forgiveness as well. I mean, I'm just thinking about my own landlords, for example, who, you know, we live in their back house. It's a public school teacher, and his wife is a fitness trainer, and they rely on the rent that we pay every month to get by. So if we couldn't pay it anymore, they would be in trouble too. So, I mean, there's a lot of people in that situation as well. So it's, we'll just see how it unfolds, but a lot of people could be impacted. And I think there's a real fear that none of this is moving quickly enough, and they're not doing dramatic enough measures to really make a dent in the crisis that could be coming.
Something we haven't talked about enough is now, like, you have to prove that your income has been affected by COVID in some way and your ability to work and all that. There's like all these hoops you have to jump through to prove that you can't afford to pay rent. But the city reopening, I assume, has made that more difficult. Because if your landlord, for example, knows that you have been able to go back to work to some extent, they can try and press you on making that payment. It's probably easier to evict you even now, because even though like cases can't go through, they are allowed to proceed with an eviction that is not related to earned non-payment. So like it all ties in with the very abrupt reopening that's happening. Anna, let's talk about the show. You have really drilled down on the process of getting someone into housing over the last year. Like you said, a woman named Christine Curtis, who lives in your neighborhood of Mid-City, was sleeping outside a fast food restaurant and had taken up a spot on a bus bench for a little while, and was just someone that you were introduced to sort of via your father-in-law. Is that right?
Yeah. So my in-laws live just about a mile away from us. And at the beginning of 2019, my father-in-law came to me and said, "Hey, I've gotten to know this woman. She lives in this mostly empty strip mall down the street from our house. And I'm bringing her food and water every now and then. A lot of the neighbors help her out, but it doesn't seem like a very efficient or helpful way to try to assist her. So do you know of any formal help that we could get her?" So I pointed him to this county website, LA Hop, where you can go online and you can request outreach for a specific person, and got the idea that I should follow this process and see what happened. Because one of the places that Measure H money is going is into street outreach. So I wanted to see how those dollars are being spent on the streets. And Measure H, of course, was the countywide sales tax increase from a few years ago that's going into homeless services. So I ended up following Christine for a year, and a lot happened. I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, no spoilers.
But, you know, a lot happened. She did get help. But you know, when I first met her, I thought in a lot of ways that she should be a relatively easy person to help, because she had lived on the streets for a long time by then, for 7 years when we met. But she was easy to find. She was always in the same place. She isn't dealing with any severe mental illness or severe addiction issue that would just impede communication with her. Or, you know, she didn't have any kind of erratic behavior going on or anything. She was open to being helped. You know, she was reluctant in some ways, but she was pretty open. And what I actually found was that the on-the-ground work of getting people indoors is done by so many different entities. There's the city, there's the county, there's LASA. Then there's this whole patchwork of nonprofits that a lot of the work gets outsourced to. They're not extremely well coordinated. They don't communicate very well with each other. It's really hard to figure out who's even in charge of this or really what the goal is of the outreach sometimes. And it really takes a dedicated person around the person experiencing homelessness to navigate all of this and to push the process forward, which Christine was lucky enough to have, but most people don't. And not only did she have that, as she had friends in the neighborhood, and one friend in particular who's a big part of the podcast, who really became her advocate, but she was also the subject of a radio documentary, which is what we're talking about, which I know from my reporting is fair to say put some extra pressure on the organizations involved to have things move forward. I'm not saying it specifically opened doors, but of course, when you do a story on something, it does change the dynamics a little bit.
You specifically, in the first episode, she makes contact with a caseworker from the People Concern, a woman named Catalina, who I love, who I know personally, who works with the SELA, the services nonprofit that I volunteer with. But as you already, in the first episode of the show, you get to something that I think is kind of an underappreciated element of getting someone on the path to housing, which is... it takes constant outreach, and there are so many ups and downs just for the person who's homeless being ready for that process to happen. I know with a lot of people, there are days when they are very so desperate to get into a place, and days where, especially as the moment gets closer, that there starts to be some anxiety around the process of moving in somewhere. Talk about that a little bit for Christine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Christine has all those ups and downs. And one of the things that I hope listeners take away from this series is that some of that resistance, it can seem very irrational, just on a superficial level. Like why wouldn't you want to go inside? Why wouldn't you accept help? But I think once you get a little immersed in her perspective and you understand more about what her daily life is like and what the options are for her, it's understandable that she would have that resistance. And you learn it's very common, as you were talking about. One of the numbers that I have in the podcast is I actually spoke to somebody in Long Beach where they've crunched some numbers on this. And they said there they found that it takes an average of 17 contacts with a person on the street before they'll accept services. And actually, by that measure, Christine was pretty easy. She, you know, she was pretty open to being helped, but she did have, you know, reasons that she was reluctant to go inside. She was very attached to her belongings and was afraid of having to get rid of them, which we talk about in the series. And I guess one of the ways I approached it was just anything that might be a question for the listener, I just had Christine explain it. I didn't want to do any talking about her behind her back, you know, or I'm talking to the listener going, gee, this doesn't seem rational, right? I would go to her and say, Christine, can you know, this people listening might not understand where you're coming from. And as you hear her explain it all, it does make sense. And actually, Catalina, I'm glad you mentioned, Catalina really, who was the original outreach worker that contacted Christine and then stayed involved with her, she really went above and beyond her job description, as you'll hear in the series. And I think it's really significant that Catalina was the only professional person involved in Christine's case who actually had lived experience of being homeless herself.
We have found, and with like Catalina specifically, like it, in a lot of cases, it does take getting the right person, and you can get the wrong person, someone who is not as engaged as you need to be to really, really help someone through this process. I think I've talked about on the show, like different people who SELA has helped get out of homelessness, who on their first night in a place, even just staying in a hotel on their way to getting into housing, was uneasy about sleeping on a bed because it was so much higher up than they were used to.
Wow.
People who had spent 8 years living on the street and then were offered a place in El Sereno, which was like pretty far from where they lived, and feeling uneasy just about being so far away from everything they knew. And they're like Christine has a lot of people. Like she has a real community there in Mid-City. She has many friends, like you included now.
Absolutely.
And mobility when you don't have a car is an issue. And like, especially when a lot of the housing that's available is not in the city center, and that's where a lot of people are homeless. Is that an issue that she runs into?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, there's a point in the series where she goes inside temporarily into a motel room and then ends up going back to the street. And she's actually, as much as she enjoys being inside, she's happy to be back. And it's because the motel is really far away from the neighborhood where she knows people and where she usually stays, and she doesn't have a car, and she's in this room with no place to walk to and nobody to talk to, and she's really isolated. So absolutely, you know, that's definitely a factor in the series. And also in terms of having the dedication that it takes to help someone navigate this process, the heart of this series really is Christine's friendship with this woman named Kim Moore, who is a housed retiree who also lives in Mid-City, who's about Christine's age. And just they just became friends. Kim was walking her dog a few years ago and happened upon Christine and bought her lunch. And she's pretty incredible. I mean, the depth of their friendship and the lengths that Kim goes to help Christine get indoors are pretty extraordinary. So, which is also to say that if you're wondering why would I want to listen to this incredibly depressing story right now, I hope that the experience of listening to it, although sad things happen, and it's not a happy topic to talk about homelessness, there is a lot of joy in it. And there is a lot of people being kind to each other. And this friendship is really at the heart of it. And there's humor in it. And I hope that one of the big takeaways is that people feel empowered to go and make changes in this crisis on their own. And I mean, like the work you're involved with, Hayes, is a perfect example of, you know, there are groups around Los Angeles that offer that opportunity that are grassroots groups like CELA that, you know, have started to do this work. There's a lot of opportunity for people to do that.
And that's what I was going to ask too, because I think what happens every year, and that's what kind of started something we did at Curbed, is, you know, people see these numbers and they immediately think like, what can I do? What can I do? Where do I give money? I think the service providers always tell us they see a big spike in people wanting to volunteer, and they think that all they could do is like go to Skid Row and like serve meals or something like that, or donate. But it really is about making that one-on-one connection with someone. And you can very easily go and find and talk to someone, sadly, in the city. It's not that hard to find someone that you might be able to create that relationship with. And once you do, it changes your mind to look beyond just like, oh, this is a charity that I need to donate to this is an action that I can take every day to stop this problem from happening. And I think that's what your series is really putting together for people. And so that's what it's really important right now.
I can speak specifically to kind of a case like that where I've talked about on the show a lot, but the couple that I've worked with who was living in Echo Park for many years, and who the woman found out that she was pregnant, and they were staying in a hotel temporarily that CELA was helping them with on Halloween of last year, and ended up staying there into April when she had the baby, and then got some help via PATH and LASA to get into bridge housing. We're in a motel for a while, finally got set up with like a place after looking at a few different options. They found a place on their own, just walking around and like called a number to get in somewhere. And then there was a really long wait for furniture because they couldn't just move into this totally empty place. And so we're in the hotel until Friday when they finally moved into this spot. And that, I mean, it was an incredibly long process. And that is fast, I would say, for the average of how these things work. But those stories and like your story with Christine on Samaritans are, it's not sad. It's very uplifting to sort of follow all the way through, even though there are sad moments, as you said. But I really encourage everyone to listen to it. Anna, thank you so much for joining. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, AnnaKCRW, and you can find Samaritans wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, KCRW app, Apple, anywhere. So thank you guys so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Thank you for listening to LA Podcast. Thank you to Brian Holmes for producing the show. Happy anniversary, Scott and Sarah. We will be back next week. Bye-bye.